your Bibles, if you have one with you this morning, to Luke chapter 2. If you don't have a Bible, there's some on the table at the back. You're welcome to borrow. If you don't own a Bible, please feel free to take one of those as our gift to you. We began a series of messages walking through Luke's gospel earlier in the fall around October. I wish I could say I planned it out this way. We are arriving at the Christmas story right in December, which seems well planned, but it's credit to God for directing us. This morning we're going to continue our study by looking at the first seven verses of Luke chapter 2. In 2002, I was in my second year of graduate studies at Regent College out in Vancouver, and my parents had divorced earlier on in my life. My mom was getting married back east in Ontario, and so in October. So we had, at that point, one child, one son, Calvin. He was about 5 months old, and if any of you have ever traveled with a child, you know that you take almost everything with you. You're loaded to the gills. And so there's a student, had to write papers. It was kind of midterm, and should I move this down? So wrote papers, had some late nights, managed to figure things out. Move it up. Managed to get things done, and we left for an extended weekend. We were students, didn't have a lot of money, so we tried to find the cheapest way there, which isn't always the most convenient way to get there. So instead of flying out of Vancouver, we drove to Seattle, flew from Seattle to Minneapolis, from where we connected to, I'm not sure whether we landed in Buffalo or Toronto, one or the other. We got east anyways. But along the way, we flew into Minneapolis late at night. We landed on the tarmac, and for security reasons, another plane was deplaning at the same gate as us, so we were stuck sitting in the plane for, I think, nearly an hour after we landed, and we had a connecting flight to get to. If any of you have ever been in the Minneapolis airport, it's shaped like a giant horseshoe. So we got off the plane, and we discovered that we'd gotten off at one end of the horseshoe, and our connecting flight was at the other end. And so we, with diaper bag and various carry-ons and nursing pillows and an infant, began making our way as quickly as we could, because it was going to be really tight, to the other end of the airport. And we ran, and I ended up carrying more, and Christine was trying to keep up, and it was just late at night, about midnight. We're tired, we're exhausted, and we arrived at our gate just in time to see our plane backing away. Just this disastrous trip. Just a mess. You're exhausted. Nothing is working out the way it should, nothing's going smoothly for us. This morning, we're going to be looking at a text in Luke about another couple making a trip in. And really, for them, they are making that trip in the midst of circumstances that are anything but ideal. It's a mess. Nothing goes smoothly. Nothing goes the way you want it to. By anyone's reckoning, far less than ideal. If you have your Bible, I want you to follow along as I read just seven verses in Luke chapter 2. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee, to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them. Can you mute me for a moment, Doug? Sorry. Locates his story, the story of the birth of Jesus, in the context of world history. He begins his narrative by telling us, in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. The story he is telling us happened in the Roman world. Caesar Augustus is in charge. These few introductory words here in Luke 2 communicate a great deal more than we might initially realize. They tell us some important things about the setting of the events, the context of Christ's coming, the events that are narrated in the verses that follow. They make us think about Rome. They make us think about Caesar. Michael Card writes these words about Caesar Augustus. Despite the aura classical scholarship sometimes casts around him, Augustus was a bloodthirsty tyrant, close to someone like Hitler or Mussolini. Augustus was born Gaius Octavius on September 19th, 63 BC, the son of a successful politician. Octavius, or Octavian as he was often called, began his rise to power during a period of chaos in the Roman Republic. The Roman Republic, with its governance by senators and legislative assemblies, was beginning to break apart, would soon give way to what would be known as the Roman Empire. Major social disorder and civil war marked the decades following his birth, Octavian's. And in time, Julius Caesar took notice of young Octavian, and Julius did what was common in those days. He adopted Octavian as his son, making him legally his son, and adding him to his will and naming him as his principal primary heir. Following the assassination of Julius Caesar, Octavian did not immediately step into power as the sole ruler of Rome. Remember, it was during this period the Republic is beginning to fall apart. The empire had not fully taken shape yet. And so for a period of time, Octavian, together with Mark Antony and another important general, Marcus Lepidus, ruled the Republic as a three-headed dictator, if you will. They issued almost immediately an edict which was called, referred to as proscription. And any man whose name was on that list was immediately sentenced to death, and all their property and material was confiscated by the state. This was partly in order to pay the Roman troops, but partly just to scare, frighten any who would oppose them. This action was long remembered as the bloodiest act of political terrorism in Roman history. In time, the relationships between Octavian and Mark Antony and this other general began to deteriorate. Octavian became increasingly powerful, and in 32 BC, he led a coup in Rome and declared war on Mark Antony, whom he defeated decisively in 31 BC in the Battle of Actium. It was shortly thereafter that the Senate bestowed upon Octavian the title Caesar Augustus. The year 27 BC is a date typically recognized by historians as the date that the Roman Empire truly had its beginning, with Caesar Augustus on the throne. He began to take decisive steps to solidify his power as the sole supreme ruler of the empire. D.S. Potter writes this: Augustus was a brutal and difficult man, feared and disliked by those who knew him best. Luke begins his telling of the story of Jesus' birth by telling us, in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. Caesar Augustus was not ordering this census so that they'd have some interesting statistics and data to put on www.romanempire.com for the benefit of the citizens of the empire. Nor was he seeking this information so that he could determine what services were needed in what part of his empire. This was about ascertaining income, property, and wealth of the inhabitants of the empire for the purposes of taxation, for the purposes, ultimately, of Caesar taking more and leaving less for those he ruled. Our story today begins, in those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. I think it's worth pausing and asking ourselves a question at this point. What thoughts run through your mind when you hear about those with political power taking steps to collect more taxes? What are the emotions that run through your heart when someone is going to demand more from you? Anger? Frustration? Helplessness? Resignation? But there's even more for us to contemplate in these few verses this morning. It's not just a matter of having the government, if you want to call it that, collecting more information for the purposes of taking more out of your pocket. It's not just about them collecting more information. In order for them to do that, they are requiring everyone to return to their hometown, to the place that they are originally from. And obviously, that's no small thing. I don't know if we pause to think about this, but think about it for a moment. Imagine this morning if all of us, for some census reasons, needed to return to our hometown. What would that mean? Like, how many of us would stay in Edmonton? There'd be a couple, right? Maybe some of you would have to, you could stay in the province, but you'd have to relocate, right? Where, like, how many would stay in Alberta but not in Edmonton? Okay, some to a neighboring province, BC or Saskatchewan. Okay, others a little further away. Some would have to leave the country, the continent even, right? Chrisleen was born in the heart of Africa to missionary parents. I mean, think about the displacement. Think about what that would mean. Now, clearly, we live in a more global context. But they didn't have planes, trains, and automobiles. This was a much more difficult journey, and everyone was required to return to their hometown. This was a major imposition on many. Even if many were already or still living in their ancestral home, which would certainly have been the case, many weren't. And for them, this census meant displacement. It meant a forced relocation. For me, it would mean a 12-hour drive to Vancouver. For Mary and Joseph, it meant a 90-mile journey, 3 days on foot. The Bible doesn't tell us that Mary rode a donkey. That's just on Christmas cards and in pageants. Perhaps she did, but we don't know that. 90 miles by foot. Back to my hypothetical trip to Vancouver, what would I have to do once I arrived? I'd have to find a place to stay, at least temporarily. And depending on how long I had to stay there and stand in the government queues, well, they entered all my statistical information so they could take more out of my pocket. I would need to maybe find a place to live longer term and perhaps even find a job. Matthew's account of Jesus' birth indicates that Joseph and Mary were in Bethlehem for around 2 years. They would have been there longer if it wasn't for Herod trying to kill Jesus, which caused them to have to relocate again to Egypt. They fled for their lives. So as we come to this text, we need to grasp this. This was not just a day trip. This was not just, hey, we're going to take off for a week to Bethlehem, and then we'll be back. This was a major wrinkle in their lives. This was forced relocation on top of the whole virgin conception and pregnancy and all that came with that for them. And get this, it gets worse. They pull into Bethlehem after 3 days on the road, and the Holiday Inn booked solid. I want to risk messing with some of our ideas, our notions of the Christmas story for a few minutes. You'll notice if you're reading from the NIV, verse 7, that we read this, "While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them." That might not be what you expected to hear if you were just listening. If you're familiar with the Christmas story, you were perhaps thinking that it would read, "because there was no room for them in the inn." That is what the previous NIV translation said. When it was revised, they changed it. Some translations translate "in," but I would suggest that the latest NIV, where it translates it "guest room," no guest room available for them, is more accurate. A few things to understand. The word that is translated here has been translated in the past, or guest room here, is a word that, strictly speaking, can mean an inn, but more generally just means a lodging place, a guest room. It's the same word that we find later on in Luke 22, when Jesus sends his disciples to find a room for them to celebrate the Passover. His instructions to his disciples are, "And say to the owner of the house, the teacher asks, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?" It's the same word. In fact, Luke, in chapter 10, when he tells the story of the Good Samaritan will take the beaten man to an inn, and it's a different Greek word that actually more specifically speaks to an inn. So Luke knows both words, Luke uses both words, and I'd suggest that the reason why he uses the word he does is because he's not strictly speaking of an inn, he's saying the guest room, the lodging place, the place where people would stay when they showed up in town. There was no room. Another couple things to bear in mind as we think about this is that Bethlehem is a small place. One scholar says the city of David was better known as the hamlet of Bethlehem. It's not like there was a whole bunch of chains of hotels lined up down the main drag, you know, Holiday Inn, Motel 6, the Hyatt. I mean, it just wasn't the reality. It's entirely possible that Bethlehem had an inn, but might not have had an actual inn either. And remember, too, that this is Joseph's hometown. Joseph knows people. He probably still has relatives that live there. And so they arrive, and other people have arrived in town, and all the guest rooms, all the places where others from out of town would stay, they're all full because others got there ahead of them. The place is bursting with people. Nathaniel was born August 8, 2002. Within about a week or two after that, Chrisleen's entire family came to visit us, to stay with us. So at that point, we had 2-year-old Calvin, newborn Nathaniel, Chrisleen and I. Her mom was already with us. Her 2 older brothers came with their wives, and between them, 7 kids between ages 6 and 13, I think. And everyone, that's 16 bodies if you're counting, stayed in our 910 square foot house for I don't remember how long. I think I must have blocked it out. But our house was full. There were bodies literally everywhere. I don't think it's unfair to imagine that really is kind of the scenario here for Mary and Joseph. They arrive in Bethlehem. They aren't the only guests there. Everyone's guest room is full. And so Mary and Joseph end up taking the only space left available, likely a ground floor level of a house where animals were sometimes stored. People typically lived upstairs. The guest room would be upstairs. But those are all full, and so they stay on the ground level. And a feeding trough was there, and it proved to be a handy, adequate crib for baby Jesus when he was born. And I mean, that's not that far hard to imagine. I know when Calvin was born, again, I was studying. We didn't have a lot of money. He slept in a laundry basket for a season. It worked. So Mary and Joseph are in this ground floor of a house, and the time comes, and Mary gives birth to a son, and there's this manger handy, and so it doubles as a crib. So I think I want to ask the question at this point, what is the point of all of this? As we read these details in the stories, we think carefully about what Mary and Joseph encountered, what they experienced. The question is fair to say, well, what are we supposed to take away from this? And there's really one thing that I want to impress upon you this morning, one thing I want you to hear, one thing I want you to see in the text, and that is this, that God enters into the mess and the brokenness of real life. That God entered the mess and the brokenness, the unsettledness, the unideal circumstances into which Jesus was born. God entered into that situation, and God enters into our brokenness, the mess, the chaos of our lives as well. This story of Christmas, this story of God putting on flesh, becoming a man in the person of Jesus, coming into the world, He came into a world that was, the situation was not ideal. Not all was well. Caesar Augustus was ruling the empire, oppressing people, extorting increasing taxes from them. Because of Augustus's edict, Joseph and Mary had to relocate. Well, she is nearly full term in her pregnancy. No time to travel, to move. And then when they arrive at their destination, other people have gotten there ahead of them, and they find themselves living in a space normally reserved for animals because there's no room in anyone's guest room. And they end up having to use a feeding trough as their son's first crib. You know, to those unfamiliar with the Christmas story, it would sound utterly preposterous that God would enter into this kind of setting. Why not into a palace? Why not into a settled place? Why not into Israel when they have their own kingdom established, their own king? There's not this oppression. There's not all this chaos and brokenness and mess going on. Why into this? Sometimes we believe that if God is present, then all will be or should be in order. All should be good. Sometimes we believe, whether we articulate it or actually think it or simply feel it in our hearts, is that the mess and the brokenness we find around us is evidence of God's absence. If God is at work, if God is stepping into action, if God is unfolding his redemptive plan, why is everything so messed up? Why do I face this frustration? Why these difficulties and hardships in life? You see, we want. Sometimes we're led to believe that a life with Christ is a life that should go easy, that if I give my life to Jesus, Jesus will give me the life that I want, that everything will go smoothly, that he'll fix the mess, that he'll make the difficulties go away. The truth we see in this story, in the Christmas story, the story of the incarnation, is that God, in taking on flesh, enters a broken, messed up world where things are not the way they're supposed to be. Far from an ideal situation. And God does not simply snap his fingers and instantly make everything better. He does not bring an immediate fix to all that is difficult or broken. He enters the mess, the brokenness, and he shares our humanity. He lives in the midst of that brokenness. Trusting on the presence of his Father, trusting on the Spirit, Jesus lives a life of obedience. And one day, because of the brokenness, in order to overcome sin and the brokenness of the world, all the pain, all the mess, Jesus bears it in his own body as he goes to the cross and suffers death for us, for the mess, for the brokenness, for the pain, for the sin of the world. Jesus enters into the mess. God in Christ entered the mess 2,000 years ago to launch his redemptive activity. He was not afraid of things being broken and far from ideal. And he's not afraid of the mess in our lives, in our world today. If you're here this morning thinking, if only I could get my act together, then I could really grow spiritually. If only I could get my life organized, I could carve out that time to be with Jesus, then he could work in me. If only I didn't have to deal with this constant frustration at work and these coworkers who drive me nuts, then God could really work in and through me. If only I didn't have to face the challenges of raising kids and being a parent, then God could accomplish his purposes and do great things. If only life was good, if only everything was the way I wanted it to be, then God could work. And I want to say to you this morning, no. In the midst of, no doubt, the frustration that Joseph and Mary felt, the challenges. Brothers and sisters, we do not have to get things fixed up in either our lives or the larger context of our world before God can accomplish his purposes. I don't know this experience personally, and I'm not pointing at anyone, but I've heard stories about people who hire housekeepers, and before the housekeeper arrives, they clean the house. That puzzles me. We don't have to fix the mess. We don't have to get our lives all in order for God to show up and work, in order for God to show up and be present and to move. Jesus is not afraid of the mess. Jesus enters into our brokenness right now. Whatever frustration, whatever difficulty, whatever pain, whatever mess you find yourself in, Jesus is present with you. God is not limited by difficulties, by brokenness, by messiness. He is not frightened away. The late Mike Iaconelli wrote in his book, Messy Spirituality, spirituality is not about being fixed. It's about God's being present in the mess of our unfixedness. Not sure if that's English, but it's powerful. Eugene Peterson, in his book, The Long Obedience in the Same Direction, says, when we sin and mess up our lives, we find that God doesn't go off and leave us. He enters into our trouble and he saves us. I get that we're talking, we can describe at least two kinds of brokenness. There's the brokenness of our world. We live in a world that's marred by sin. There's also that personal brokenness. We recognize in our own selves our sin, our rebellion, our weakness, our frailty. God enters into our brokenness. God enters into the mess. You do not have to clean yourself up before God will move.
God comes into the mess. That's the gospel. Jesus came into a broken world. He didn't come to Israel in the glory days when David was on the throne. He came when they were under Roman oppression. He came to parents who were poor and experienced forced relocation. He came into their lives when they were barely had a place to stay. He came into the mess, the frustration, the difficulty, the hardship. And whatever it is you're walking through today, I want you to know that God is not frightened by the mess. God is present with you. He says, never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. Are you feeling broken today? Are you experiencing difficulties and challenges in life right now that just have you so flustered and frustrated that you don't know which way is up? And maybe you're feeling really alone in that. Maybe you're feeling stuck and lost and you just long, oh God, if only you'd fix this. I want to say, one, God is at the process of setting all things right. One day, all will be as it should be. But even right now, God is with you. God is present in the mess. He is present in the brokenness. The mess does not scare him. The brokenness does not hinder him. The difficulties do not stop him. He is present. He loves you. He's walking with you. He's at work in you and around you and through you in small, sometimes unseen ways. In the backwater hamlet of Bethlehem, in the ordinary lives of men and women like us in this room today. Know this. Messiness is the context in which God is present and at work. Messiness is the context into which Christ came. Messiness is the context into which Christ still comes today. Amen.